dad was a referee, so I'm very sensitive to referees. In saying that, I see how it's very easy to say, oh, this guy has it out for me. Jory Crawford of the NBA, his personality was just a very volatile personality.
Rick Bucher.
I worked as a D-League ref, and I also shadowed Joey and his crew. I know, as you knew from your father, people want to assume that they have an agenda. They don't come in with a specific agenda. The vast majority, they're just trying to do their job.
This is the BJ Armstrong and Rick Bucher Show, starring BJ and Bucher.
Welcome to yet another episode of the BJ and Bucher podcast, Four Quarters of Madness. He is BJ Armstrong. I'm Rick Bucher. Fourth quarter, we're going to have a guest, Casey Johnson of the Chicago Tribune, covers the Chicago Bulls. Both BJ and I know him well. He probably knows BJ better than he'd like, having had to cover the days of Derrick Rose there and all that went on there. But we will get to all that. BJ, I welcome you to the show. Let's start here. James Harden, having a phenomenal season, had a triple-double the other night against the Blazers, has put himself back in the MVP conversation as he was 2 years ago, fell off dramatically last year. So I have to ask you, as you see this resurgence by James, is this James simply getting back to who he was 2 years ago? Or when you look at the triple doubles and the number of assists, is this Mike D'Antoni's system? Or are we seeing a James Harden that we've never seen before?
Well, we're seeing a James Harden who has the ball in his hand 99.9% of the time, you know, a la Steve Nash. This is a point guard driven offense, high powered offense, where he's making every decision, screen roll, fast break, half court. And he's getting an opportunity to post massive numbers. And he's statistically, he is playing incredible basketball. Now, what does that mean as far as teams going to make adjustments, how far they go? Who knows? But right now, no one can dispute that James Harden is putting up massive numbers. And if he continues to play like this, I mean, he's going to have statistically as good of a season as you've seen at that point guard position.
Okay, so but I know how you feel about statistics. Compare this to what Russ Westbrook is doing. And again, is putting up statistically some amazing numbers. But is there anybody else out there in the league that you look at the way they're playing and say, I don't care about the numbers. This is a real MVP. Because, by the way, these numbers, most of the numbers that we're citing have nothing to do with the defensive
yes.
end of the floor.
Yep.
And I don't know that James is necessarily any different at that end of the floor to say that we're seeing a different James Harden.
Well, when you have, you know, I just refer to it now as analytical basketball. Cheesecake basketball. And what I mean by cheesecake basketball, it's commercial. It's commercial basketball. Guys come in, they play screen roll. You know, you put the ball in your best player's hands and you just allow him to facilitate and make all the decisions. Now, at some point here, teams are going to make defensive adjustments. And then what are you going to do? So right now, it's early in the season. Every team, every coach is trying to figure out his core. Every team is trying to figure out how they're going to win games. And you can see the other night, if you had a chance to see Houston versus Oklahoma, how they double-teamed James. And, you know, that was a really good win for Oklahoma.
Right.
There. So teams are going to make adjustments. I'm going to see how this thing plays out. But I don't want to take away from what he's doing, because the numbers he's putting up right now are massive numbers. In talking and referring to James Harden, Russell Westbrook is putting up massive numbers. But how does it translate to winning basketball and a winning culture and all those things? You know, time will tell.
It sounds as if you would take away a little bit from an MVP, because we looked at Steve Nash, and Steve Nash won a couple of MVP awards, and he was in the Mike D'Antoni system. And not to take anything away from what Steve Nash was doing, but obviously people are, you know, they're captivated by the statistics, and that drives the MVP conversation. Do you make a distinction? If you look at this, is it really just Mike D'Antoni and the fact that his system provides more possessions, more opportunities, and then you have a guy who's dominating the ball, his numbers are going to skyrocket?
Again, it takes an exceptional talent. And I want to make this clear. James Harden and Russell Westbrook are exceptional talents. Now, in order to win, you must incorporate the other 11 guys on the team. in order to complement, and there has to be a balance. Now, when is that balance going to occur? Because clearly we know we have a guy that can get 25 plus points night in and night out. We know a guy that's going to demand a double team. We know we have a guy who can do all those things.
Are you channeling your inner Hubie Brown right now?
Well, I am, because it's very difficult when you just depend on one guy. You can't just win in this league with one player. So at some point here, Coach D'Antoni and Coach Donovan, they're going to have to figure out how to implement the other guys if they're going to have a successful season. You just can't give the ball to one player and say, just go win it for us. Now, will that happen maybe a handful or 10 times a year? Of course, those guys are good enough to do it. But if you're talking about actually advancing to the playoffs and really making a run at this, the other guys are going to have to figure out, and the coaches are going to have to figure out how to implement these guys into the fold.
All right, moving on. The other topic that we wanted to hit is something that we actually addressed in part on this show with Brendan Serr, associate head coach for the LSU Tigers. We talked to him about Ben Simmons and the documentary that's out called One and Done by Showtime that was very critical, is very critical of the whole one and done idea, and had Ben Simmons talking negatively about the one and done, the fact that you have to spend a year somewhere before you can enter the NBA. Some guys do it spend it in college. Some guys spend it overseas. But in any case, it was enough of an issue that NCAA president and former LSU chancellor Mark Emmert went on the record and said, "Hey, look, the one and done thing, that's not, don't blame the NCAA. That's not us. That's the NBA rule." And while he's making that clear, and I have my issues, I have plenty of issues with how the NCAA does their business.
I have a whole bucket list of issues with this. But continue.
So, well, let's start there. Is there something about the way the NCAA conducts itself that informs or contributes to this issue?
Well, I'm going to comment about this particular issue here, and not, we can spend hours on end, you know, discussing this. This is a double-edged sword for me from this viewpoint. Every player is not a one-and-done player. I want to make that clear. Every player is not a one-and-done player.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is, just because you go to college and you average whatever, 18 points a game, or you're freshman of the year, that doesn't mean that you're actually prepared to come and play and participate in the NBA. There are a handful of players that physically, mentally, psychologically are ready to make that jump. And you can't treat everyone the same. You can't say every player is a Carmelo Anthony, a one and done player. You can't say every player is a LeBron James,
okay,
where he doesn't have to go to college at all. Let's look at this particular instance. And it was very disappointing to see how it was handled on Ben Simmons' part, right? If that's how he felt, that's how he felt. And why did he go to college then, if that was the case? Why did he go to college? Because
he's saying because he had to.
Well, there were other options. He could have played professionally. I mean, you've seen players like Brandon Jennings. You've seen players like Emmanuel Mudiay. You've seen players who've gone on, played professionally, whether it's in Europe, in China, and other venues to develop. So
yeah,
he had other options, but it doesn't do anyone good by slamming this person or slamming that person. Choose what's best for you in your situation and in your development, and then go from there.
So what do you think the rule should be? Should guys be, because in my mind, guys should be able to come out of high school. That should be an option, and you need to make the best decision for yourself.
What I think is, there should be no rules. There should be no rules. I can't ask a kid to be an adult. I learned this lesson watching the Chris Webber and Don Nelson fiasco years and years ago. Let a kid be a kid and let an adult be an adult. Now, if a kid makes a decision to turn pro and puts his name in the draft, the people that are choosing and drafting these kids, why do they have to draft them?
So you're suggesting that the responsibility, if you draft a young kid, you are now responsible for developing that young kid?
Absolutely. The thing that upsets me is, just because a kid puts his name in the draft doesn't mean you have to draft him. But what I know is the fear, if you don't want to be the guy who drafts Todd Fuller in front of Kobe Bryant.
Yes.
It's fear driven. So when these kids come out, these executives and scouts are so afraid to miss the next Kevin Garnett, the next LeBron James, the next year, that they draft these kids on fear. They draft them on fear and then criticize and try to find themselves a way to protect themselves of saying, well, we had to draft such and such player, or we had to do this. No, you don't have to do this. You actually have a choice. You don't have to draft this player. You don't have to pay that player. You actually have a choice, people, in what it is you want to do. So you should be allowed to put your name in. And if it doesn't happen for you, you should take that responsibility. And I can assure you, if enough of these kids who aren't ready to play don't get drafted, they will second guess themselves of whether or not it is actually right to put my name in the draft or not. You can't ask a 19-year-old kid and put him around 28, 29, 30-year-old men who are married with kids and ask them to function. Now, some kids can. Some kids can handle that. But some kids can't. And the majority of them can't handle that.
All right. Moving on to the second quarter. If you thought that subject was a hot topic, wait for this one.
No.
You are deep in this. This is in your wheelhouse, BJ Armstrong. It is the firestorm that was created by Phil Jackson referring to, I believe specifically, I think he was at one point he talked generally about the players, the friends, the hangers-on that are around a player. And he referred...
Whoa. This is hot, Rick. This is hot.
Yes, referred to those people around a player as their posse.
He escaped from me. I was just going to round up a posse to go after him.
And did it in a negative way. And was, I believe, because this has taken so many twists and turns, the original comment had to do with LeBron James and his group. And Pat Riley dealing with LeBron and his friends and not allowing them to run roughshod on being on the team playing, etc., the way that they had, the liberties that they had in Cleveland. And he believes that it is detrimental. In his book, he wrote about how it's detrimental to players to have these group of, it's not even enablers, it's a group of, most people say hangers-on, whatever, but he referred to them as a posse. LeBron took that very personally. I want to know where you're going to go with this with Phil Jackson, BJ, because it's so complicated. LeBron really made it sound as if this was Phil Jackson saying something that was racially charged and showed a prejudice toward young black men.
Well, I'm a 50-year-old black man in America. I want to start there. I want to start right there. And then I want to start and address the real issue at hand. How do we define that word posse? How do we define that?
Mm-hmm. When you say we, see, this is an important part of it.
When I say we, I'm going to go right to the dictionary. Rick, I'm glad you asked that question. I just happened to went to the dictionary and I found out. Here is the definition of the word posse. A group of people who are together for a particular purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to go back to what I said at the beginning of this conversation. I'm a 50-year-old black man in America. I don't have a problem with that word posse, right?
Okay.
I don't have a problem. Now, but I do understand that in different vernacular, mm-hmm. that word could have different meanings.
Right. So... But this is important. This is important because you're saying, I don't take issue with the word. Do you take issue with Phil Jackson using the word in the context that he did?
See, Rick, it's all about how you view yourself. I view myself. I always encourage young people when I come in contact with young people. And I make constant contact with young people. View yourself as the CEO or the boss of the situation. Never, ever put yourself as anyone's victim. Okay, now, if you put yourself as the boss of the situation, here was my reply of all my young people that I spoke to. I said, what do you think about the situation? And they said, because we have a saying here, I'm with you, Rick, when you're right. I'm with you when you're right. That's kind of our ad lib within my little community world, right? A lion, he don't concern himself over the opinions of the sheep or the gazelles out there. I'm a lion, Rick. I'm the CEO. Why am I worried about the opinions of someone else? What I care about is handle your business and do what you need to do and take care of yourself.
It's so interesting you say that because, yeah, and this part I agree with wholeheartedly. If you don't think it applies to you, then let it go because it doesn't apply to you. It doesn't apply to your situation. And you could leave it at that place. I just, knowing what I know about Phil Jackson, once upon a time, Cleveland reached out for him to coach there. Phil Jackson wasn't interested. Phil Jackson didn't want to coach LeBron James. There aren't too many coaches who would say they didn't want to coach LeBron James. Phil Jackson was one of them. And you can't tell me that and LeBron's awareness of that isn't coloring this whole thing. Or Stan Van Gundy weighing in and the rivalry between the Van Gundys and Phil Jackson.
Look, this is the way I saw it. Where I'm looking at it from a dude that, man, I don't have no personal ties to Phil Jackson, covered him, never none of that. I just watched him on TV.
Right.
LeBron, when he went to look that up, what he saw was the word gang and mob as synonyms to that word. And typically, when we think of those words in terms of people, groups of people, it's always a bad thing. So LeBron felt like, dude, you calling me and my boys gang members.
Yeah.
This is a negative connotation that's been put on inner city black men since I was a kid in the 80s.
I get that LeBron is, what LeBron was saying. But I wonder if that's how he presented it publicly, when the other part of this is that people in the NBA have long looked at Mav Carter and they've looked at Rich Paul and the position that they have and the power that they have. Mav in particular makes no bones about sort of wearing his power, like letting people know I'm the CEO for LeBron James. And that rubs some people the wrong way because they look at it and go, dude, you're in your position because you're boys with LeBron James because you grew up with him. Now, that may be unfair as far as recognizing the businessman that Maverick Carter has become. With Rich, I've seen Rich go out and grind. So, and maybe Maverick has too. I know Rich has, but I can't help but feel that LeBron's reaction was as much as, you're not respecting my guys. As much as it was, you're saying something that is racially charged. Does that make sense?
Look, when we live in a society we live in right now, where we just came off of this racially charged election, and now you got people being appointed to the White House to run the country who are part of the alt-right, all of that stuff is still a fresh wound. So when you pour salt in it, words like posse that have no meaning prior to all of this Trump stuff, words like posse would have never, it would have never even bothered LeBron. But now it bothers him because of the climate we're in.
It was a poor choice of words. What Maverick and all the other people that we're discussing here and all those other people, his people, okay, whatever those people, the word posse is what we're discussing here. And I want to always get it back. What he's thinking, that word choice,
right?
I think we will all agree,
right,
was a poor choice.
What are you doing? It's just a halftime.
Yes, this is my favorite part of the game.
We need a halftime, man.
Oh,
we need a musical break. We need to kick back.
We need a hug.
We need something to let us chill, and then we'll come back. We'll have a little trivia. We'll have some fun.
Yeah, man. I got a good one. This is a Dodd featuring Black Thought from The Roots. This is called Holding On. Giving right, stepping out of the door. Feel your jaws getting tight now. Embrace the hate. That's what it takes. The right, what I write. A lot of people don't like what I like. Despite the hype, yo, I'ma write what I like. If you ready for war, you got the right one at night. Cause I'm ready for your. Plus I'm nice with the mic. Face it, I'm gonna make it cash. I'm gonna take it. Whoever set a record to pass, I'm gonna break it. I'm not about finishing last. I won't chase it. I got to get it. I got to go place. This ain't your style.
One hand on my money, one hand on the news. They tell me hope was gone, but I'm holding on, cause I know
I'm gonna make it.
Yeah,
it's the third quarter, and you know what that means. It is time to test our knowledge of trivia and just how much BJ and I don't know. Let's find out. BJ, on November 30th, 1996, Michael Jordan scored his 25,000th point in his 782nd NBA game, becoming the second fastest to 25,000 points behind which player? Here are the choices. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Dr. Julius Erving, Wilt Chamberlain, Oscar Robertson. Who was the fastest to 25,000 points?
Who was the fastest?
Who was the fastest? That is the question. I gave you four options.
I'm just going to say the Big Dipper.
Well done. Well played, my friend.
The Big Dipper.
Score one for BJ.
The Big Dipper. Okay.
Yes.
This player scored 31 points and grabbed 31 boards on November 12th, 2010. A, Dwight Howard. B, Kevin Love. C, LeBron James. D, Carmelo Anthony.
I am going to say it was the White Wonder in Minnesota who got those numbers, because I looked at them and said, I'm not even sure they won the game, but he got like a 30-30, and I'm like, man, those are amazing.
Yes, it is. Kevin Love. He became the first player to put up these numbers since Moses Malone did it in 1982.
He lost more games with amazing numbers than any player maybe in the history of the NBA.
But he put up the numbers.
All right. This player shocked the NBA world by registering 15 blocks, 24 points, and 28 rebounds on November 20th, 1993. That player was Patrick Ewing, David Robinson, Shaquille O'Neal, or Hakeem Olajuwon.
I'm just going to say Dream, because Dream would put up some crazy numbers. So I'm going to say Dream.
That is incorrect.
Oh, did David
Robinson? Correct answer was Shaquille O'Neal as a rookie put up 15 blocks, 24 points, and 28 rebounds.
Wow, that's a big-time effort. Oh, wow, that is...
All right, here's my opportunity. Here's my window. And by the way, the payoff for this is supposed to be the loser is supposed to have to tweet out, I don't know more about the game than my co-host,
shame,
at
shame.
Blank,
yeah,
hashtag BJ and Bucher.
Shame,
that hasn't been happening.
Shame.
So
no, it hasn't.
What I'm suggesting is Shane has to take this over, and Shane has to somehow, somebody else
Shane.
Has to make the loser pay.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
game
the
on.
Voluntary thing's not happening.
Game on.
All right. So here it is. Here's the question. Here it is. This player became the youngest player in NBA history to score 20 points and 20 rebounds in a game. A, Dwight Howard. B, LeBron James. C, Al Jefferson. D, Shaquille O'Neal.
Woo! Well, now here's the trick part, because I could use the answer to the previous question and say it was Shaquille O'Neal, since he put up those phenomenal numbers. Did those numbers apply? Yeah, he crossed that threshold. You said...
You can't be looking it up.
Well,
you gotta just
well but here's
the
thing.
Top.
I don't think... he came out as a junior, so I think he was older. Al Jefferson came out as a high school player. Dwight Howard came out as a high school player. So it really comes down to this. It's between Dwight Howard and Al Jefferson. And now I'm going to go psychological. Because see, answering these questions correctly, we don't know the answers. A lot of this has to do is you got to figure out what's the psychology of the person asking the question.
Shane, do we get a time limit on it before you get the answer?
That's where you have to go. So I am going, this. I'm not reading you, BJ. You're no longer my competition. Shane Freeman is my competition. It's between Dwight Howard and it's between Al Jefferson. And Shane Freeman has okey-doked me enough times on this show already that I'm going to say he was going for that one more time. So I'm going to say it was Al Jefferson.
He's absolutely wrong.
Oh, he dunked you again.
Damn it. Was it Dwight Howard?
I love it.
That was my opportunity.
This guy was on his Oh God, he overthought.
Way
he
overthought it.
What if I have a fatal flaw? It's overthinking things. Yeah, for sure.
All right.
So we need a tiebreaker.
Yeah, and I got one for you. Now this is Jeopardy rules, fellas. Jeopardy rules. So that means that the first person to answer correctly will win the game. Now, mind you, I'm not going to penalize you like I did last time, where the first person who answered incorrectly would lose. This time it's going to be the first person who answers correctly wins the game, okay?
Okay.
So here we go.
I'm sweating right now, by the way. I got to tell you that this segment, just the thought of doing this segment before we do the show makes me sweat. All right.
Well, good. That means it's serving its purpose. All right. How many rebounds did Wilt Chamberlain grab against Bill Russell on Thanksgiving Day 1960? A, 54. B, 55. C, 56. D, 57.
54.
Do I have to answer?
Yeah, Rick, what say you?
No, he can just be wrong, right?
No, I'm saying the first person that answers it correctly.
Oh, so he's got it wrong already.
I could have it right. Shane could just not be answered.
I'm going to say 56. 56.
Keep going.
Damn. 57.
DJ, what say you?
55.
Ding, ding, ding. Ah, damn it. That was by process of elimination.
That's all it is, just process of elimination.
That's right. You know what? It really is. It really is. All right. No, let's have some more fun. Let's welcome in our next guest for the fourth quarter, Casey Johnson from the Chicago Tribune, coming up. It is a pleasure to welcome in our next guest, Casey Johnson, the distinguished beat writer for the Chicago Bulls, for the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to the show, Casey.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Casey, it is great to have you in the house. None of this politically correct stuff. We're getting right into it. We're getting up under the ground. We're getting into the sewer systems of Chicago. We want to know the real inside scoop.
So I want to start here. How happy are you that Derrick Rose and BJ Armstrong are no longer associated with the Chicago Bulls and you can cover the team in peace?
Okay, here we go.
KC, very carefully, KC. This is a podcast.
Now you're asking to measure his words. No, I want the truth.
I'll answer it factually and say that BJ is still associated with the team because his client is Denzel Valentine, the first round pick of the Chicago Bulls. So there you go.
Very, very true.
Oh, man. No, that was a crazy franchise altering trade back in June.
Well, and this is what I'd really like to get into and why we're having you on, KC, because I look at that and I look at where the Chicago Bulls were going, and it felt as if they were hitting the reset button. And now you look at what they've put together with Rajon Rondo, with Robin Lopez, with Dwayne Wade, and the way that they are playing. How surprised are you? What do you make of what the Chicago Bulls have done in the post-Derrick Rose era?
Well, they're certainly one of the surprise early season stories of the NBA. They're playing at a high level. Look, when management made the decision to trade Derrick in June, they had no idea that Dwayne Wade would be on the Bulls. So, and you know, at that point, I don't think anybody thought that Dwayne Wade would be on the Bulls, including Dwayne Wade. So that part of the plan was fortuitous, and I don't think I think Dwayne's impact on this franchise has been immeasurable to this point. He's a true leader in every sense. He's strong on the court, leadership off the court, good with the media, good in the community. He's just got one of these palpable presences that you feel on every level of an organization. So that was very fortuitous for Dwayne to fall into management's laps, and I think everything's just kind of fallen into place from there.
KC, you've touched on it in your previous answer, but can you expand on what Dwayne Wade has meant to the organization, not on the court? We know what he does on the court. I mean, this guy is a Hall of Fame type player. He's had an incredible career. He's a champion. But what has he done? What kind of impact has he had on Jimmy Butler? What kind of impact has he had off the floor? because I said in our previous podcast, you know, they've been one of the surprise teams thus far in the early season, how they've been able to play defensively, how they come together as a team. And really, they've been able to compensate, which we all thought at the beginning of the season, you know, shooting was going to be a problem. But they found ways defensively and really getting key contributions on the bench from the younger guys, from players that we didn't know. So what has he done? What has he really done that you see on a day-to-day basis covering this team?
Right. So something that really kind of stands out and resonates every time I think about Dwayne is something that somebody that's known him for a long time told me shortly after he verbally committed to the Bulls. He's not only a Hall of Fame player, he's a Hall of Fame teammate. And I think what Dwayne is really, really good at doing, and look, I can't claim to know the guy intimately yet. I've only covered him a little bit here, but I've obviously watched him for many years and been around him in group situations. But what I will say that I think that he does expertly is he comes in and he reads the situation, he reads the team, he reads different personalities, and he figures out how to assimilate himself and lead different styles, different players, different ways. And so everything kind of falls into place from there. Just look at this. This is a perception from afar because I didn't cover this team, but just look at when LeBron came and formed the big three with him and Bosch in Miami. He had to change kind of how he played to fit alongside LeBron. And there was obviously, as we all know, some early season growing pains in that first season together. But, you know, ultimately, look at what they did, you know, all those trips consecutively to the finals. And Dwayne figured out how to make it work. He also played alongside Shaq. He can basically adapt to any situation. As for what that means to Jimmy Butler, it means that Dwayne can be the leader that he is, and Jimmy can fall in line behind that. But Dwayne can lead while still propping up Jimmy and letting Jimmy do the damage that he's done to this point. And Jimmy's playing at an extremely high level.
Well, that's what's most amazing to me is that we have Jimmy Butler, who I believe some people around the team were referring to as hostile takeover last year, to be the leader, right?
Where do you come up with this?
I do my homework. I talk to people. You have Rajon Rondo, who is a very unique character. And for all of Dwayne Wade's ability to assimilate, it's still extraordinary. And then Robin Lopez is his own kind of character. My big question was, on paper, I saw where, long range shooting aside, they could be a great team. But I questioned that the chemistry could come together. And I guess there's still a part of me wondering whether the chemistry can last. So, KC, you're around them. Why is the chemistry as good as it appears to be? And can it last?
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously there's that skepticism that still lingers out there, and I could be horribly wrong. I have been many times before. I think it is going to last because this is what I'm talking about Dwayne's leadership. It's very impressive in the sense that he can lead. And look, the day he was introduced to the media, he said, "This is Jimmy Butler's team." Okay, but you mean to tell me that, you know, when it's still crunch time, that Dwayne's not going to make his impact felt? I mean, he is. Right. So that's my point. He can prop up somebody else and let that person feel emboldened and understand that there are times he's going to cede to the younger, you know, two-time All-Star player that's on a, you know, early season MVP path, but yet still, you know, have his impact and his presence felt. And that's I don't even know where that comes from, but he's got that skill. And, you know, as far as whether or not it can last, I mean, I can just tell you the vibe around this team is so completely different to the vibe around last season's team. If beat writers can feel it, it's even stronger within the framework of the team because these guys are doing stuff together off the court. That team last season had just reached the finish line. It had just, that run was over, and it was a wearying feel to that team last season, and that's no longer the case this season.
Most people don't notice, but KC has a little game with him. Big-time player.
Oh,
KC's a big-time player.
Whoa. You went from little game to big-time player.
No, he's a big-time player. He's a big-time player. He understands his role on the team. He understands. Unlike you, Rick, who just shoots all the balls, KC is, you know, he understands his role on the team. So he's a big-time player. He's a big-time player.
I just talked to Shane Battier, and he said, I asked him, did he have any regrets from when he played? And he said, I wish I had shot him. I will not have that regret.
Well, that's for sure. And anyone who's ever played with you understands that
you know, Rick Bucher is not comfortable with himself as a basketball player. Before I let you go, you know, you and I have spent many years in Chicago. You got to give me your best and favorite Jerry Krause story. I can't let you on the show. I can't let you on the show without giving me your best Jerry Krause story.
Oh, man, there's so many. And I actually, you know, I've gotten to know Jerry very well in retirement on a personal level. And I know you have a personal relationship with him as well. So I'll keep the personal relationship aspect out of the memories. But I mean, boy, oh boy. I think I've got to go with the one where he traded Ron Artest. I can't call him Meta World Peace. I'm sorry. I have to call him Ron Artest.
I agree with that. He is Ron Artest.
We call him Ron Artest on the show, so you're good.
Okay, yeah. I mean, when they cover a guy as a rookie, it kind of sticks. So anyway, he traded Ron Artest to the Pacers, and it was Ron was in the practice facility, the Berto Center, the late grade Berto Center in Deerfield, Illinois, and headed to Indiana. And Ron was a little taken aback by the trade, and Ron left the building and decided once he left the building that he needed a souvenir to remember his stint with the Bulls by. There's a long hallway of pictures at the Berto Center, of individual pictures of each player. And Ron decided to come back in and rip his out of the drywall and tuck it underneath his arm. And when he did so, Jerry Krause was there, and Jerry was, you know, apoplectic. He could not believe that Ron had done this and created this large hole in the Berto Center. And he was like, you can't do that. You can't do that. And Ron tucked it under his arm and strolled out of the Berto Center with a souvenir framed picture of himself. So that one kind of comes to mind.
Oh, God. Jerry was
fantastic.
Yeah, it is. Well, Casey, we really appreciate you coming on. It's always a pleasure. You're a first-class person, and thank you again for coming on our show. And hopefully we'll have you again. We're very appreciative for you taking the time.
Thanks for having me. And when you brought me on and we were talking about how long we've known each other, I thought you guys were going to ask me for the scouting report on Bucher's game, because that's when we first met back
then. Oh, wow.
Second three-peat run.
You know what? Unfortunately, we're out of time.
Games in Seattle and Salt Lake City. Come on. I played with Rick so many times during the 96 to 98 finals. It's unbelievable.
Did he ever pass you the ball, Casey? Just tell us.
I would just say I strongly agree with BJ's assessment of Rick's game. That's all.
You guys think that's funny, huh? In all seriousness, Casey, thank you so much for taking the time. It's always a pleasure when we cross paths, and I look forward to that happening very soon. In the meantime, stay safe and have a great Thanksgiving.
See you guys down the road. Thank you.
All right. That was Casey Johnson from the Chicago Tribune. He's covered the Bulls for quite some time, and he is one of those guys BJ can attest to. There's certain guys who cover the beat, and they cover the beat, and you get to know them as people, and you trust them, and you can have conversations both on and off the record, and they really have a feel for what's going on, and they're true to that. They're not just looking to gut somebody with a story, and yet Casey also has the ability to break stories and give you what's really going on. So it's a delicate balance, and he is able to execute it. By the way, you have been listening to the BJ and Bucher Four Quarters of Madness podcast. Appreciate you joining us. As always, you can subscribe to make sure that you don't miss a single episode. Subscribe on iTunes or iCloud, and do us a favor. Review the show. Let us know how we're doing. Leave us a comment about what you like, don't like, what we could do better. Because ultimately, this podcast is all about you, the listener. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.